I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm the dude, so that's what you call me.
Let's go get sushi and not pay.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Hoo-ah!
Hey everyone, and welcome to the premiere episode of the Furious Cinema Podcast. I'm Pete Roberts, and I'm here with my co-host, Sebastian Hasselbeck, who is joining us from beautiful downtown Berlin, Germany. Hey, Seb. Great talk to you, man.
Hey, Pete. How are you?
Doing good.
So, yeah, everyone, that's thanks for joining us. As an intro, in case you're not familiar with who we are, we started Furious Cinema, I think, about 10 or 11 years ago, right? You can visit it at furiouscinema.com, and we have all kinds of reviews from the last couple of years and articles about genres and the movies we like. And we're not angry as in furious, but to be honest, we're really nice people. When it comes to movies, we do have a lot of passion, hence the name. And as the name should imply, we do like movies that are a little bit more furious, ballsy, daring, wild, whatever you want to call it. And there's a few movies that are the inspiration for Furious Cinema, where we get the name from. And as you might have heard in the jingle, one of them is Network, where Neil shouts out the window, right?
We're mad as hell. We won't take it anymore.
Yeah, we're not going to take boring movies anymore and the mainstream mumbo jumbo. We want some movies that put us on the edge. That's what we want to achieve with Furious Cinema. And now we start the podcast.
So since we first started Furious Cinema, we posted a lot of reviews of our favorite films and on the blog, and have spent a long time talking about movies on social media like Twitter and stuff. It took us a while, but we finally decided to try starting a podcast too. So this is a brand new format, and we hope you'll be patient with us as we get into it and find our way. It'll also be the first real live discussions me and Seb have had since we usually just communicate via email. But if you love movies like we do, you should enjoy our blog and hopefully our podcast once we get things rolling. It should be noted that we're not professional film scholars with degrees in cinema history. We're just lifelong movie geeks.
Yeah, I do have master's degrees in being furious, however.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah. So I think it's absolutely fantastic that we're going to explore some podcasting. I think both of us, we've listened to a lot of podcasts over the last couple of weeks. And that's also the reason that, you know, the two of us, we thought we'd pick a topic for the first episode that that got us both really excited and busy, actually, you know, listening to podcasts and reading articles. And it's a topic that allows us to explore a lot of different avenues to discuss Furious Cinema and what that means to us. And we'll be discussing a new book. And it's a movie podcast, but we're going to discuss a book for our first episode. And it's by a filmmaker that you might be familiar with. And it's the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood novelization by Quentin Tarantino, of course. And like the structure of the book, Pete and I will be jumping a little bit from topic to topic. But obviously, it goes without saying that we will be covering spoilers. So we do recommend that, you know, it's better that you've seen the movie and you've read the book. And of course, we'll wait while you do that and you come back and join us. And so, yeah, I think let's get right in there, Pete. The novelization, why are we talking about this?
Well, the novel, we both saw the movie. We loved the film. And the book is really like a treasure trove of, it's like a even more of a expansion of like the universe of the movie. We'll have to like not get to everything. We'll have to skip some things because it's just, there's so many details and stuff in there. It's very dense with pop culture facts and anecdotes. So what we're going to do is just kind of like, you know, skim over and pick out some of the things that we found were the most interesting. And I thought we'd start with like the look and the style of the book, just to start.
Yeah, and in a way, and maybe that's one of the things that both of us like, is that what Tarantino does is he uses also the format and the medium. It's almost as important as the content, and it brings us back to a time that both of us are too young for is the movie novelizations that you would find in the spinner racks at a 7-Eleven or so.
A novelization? Have you ever read one?
I don't think so, but since I'm so young, but I wouldn't rule out that I read maybe one of the newer novelizations that would probably count more as movie merch for children's movies. Maybe I've read like a Free Willy picture book or something.
I never read a novelization, but like when I was growing up, I collected a lot of making of, like behind the scenes books. Like, I don't know if you've seen those, like the making of Batman or something like that. Like, you know, I collected those, but I never read any novelizations. I just wasn't like into that, but you know, comic books and stuff, that's, it was more my thing. But
yeah, and it's not his first novelization, if you so will. I mean, he did partner up with someone, and they did the Django Zorro graphic novel, right?
That was like a graphic novel, yeah, right.
Yeah, and what I found interesting is that there's kind of a parallel where, you know, apparently he went to the publisher and said he wanted to do like a mass market paperback, and there's right. obviously not much money in it unless you become a bestseller, which this one did. But he did a similar thing with The Hateful Eight, where he said, you know, he wants to do that in 70mm and bring the format back, and right. he really did. And maybe he's bringing back novelizations now. Maybe we'll see more of those.
Yeah, I mean, that's really cool. I mean, that's, you know, I think I understand the novelizations more than the 70mm, just because it's so tough to like get that into the cinemas. You know what I mean? Not every, you know how not every theater is equipped for the 70mm. It was sort of
It was a really exclusive thing
for that. But I mean, you know, that was cool too. But it's mm-hmm. just tough to do that, as we know, with all the, you know what I mean, they're shutting down like the ArcLight, so it's like, you know, they're really getting rid of all these old school formats almost in a way.
Yeah, and him running the New Beverly is also about format. I mean, they only show movies right. on film,
right? 35mm only, no digital,
or 16mm in rare cases.
Right, we'll have to get there one of these days. I still haven't been to the New Beverly. You have though, right?
Yeah, I've been there twice. It's quite awesome. An experience, as they say. This is like going to church for movie fans.
Old school stuff. Yeah, the old school ways. I mean, like, you know, back when I was growing up, I went to like more theaters that were like that. But I mean, it's been a long time since I went to like a real 35mm only movie theater, probably like 20 years now.
Yeah, I'm just lucky that I live in a bigger city. So we do have like a Revival House, and we have some smaller art house cinemas. And
you're lucky because of that.
Sometimes I get to watch stuff on old prints, but that's a luxury. I mean,
it is.
Today, only the bigger cities have these.
Yep. So what's the next thing we'll be talking about here?
So I think that the format brings us a little bit on what the movie is about and how it differs from maybe the movie. And obviously, if you're listening, you've read the book. And what strikes us is that maybe let me start like this. It deviates from the movie in some way, as it expands some things. There's something in there that you would call flashbacks, maybe.
Yeah, really what it does is it expands on a lot of stuff, and it switches things around, leaves other things from the movie completely out. And then it has other chapters that are like just inside the Lancer universe. If you've seen the movie, the Lancer Western, it's almost like a real Western story inside that universe. It doesn't talk about Rick and, you know, the actors. It's just more of like actually the real, like an episode from the show, like, but it's like in the book form, which is really cool. You know what I mean? So he really expand. He didn't do like a regular novelization where it's just like a screenplay, like adapted for a book. He like really took it deeper, and he, all different perspectives. And, you know, it was really great. Awesome.
Yeah. And he switches narrators too. So for the most part, he's like an omniscient narrator, or he lets his characters talk. But then for the Lancer stuff, he takes a stab at, you know, writing like, I don't know, Elmore Leonard, or what's the other guy's name? Louis L'Amour.
Yeah. The guy that I forget what he wrote. It was like Lonesome Dove or something. I don't know which one it was, something like that, but.
Yeah, and what I like is that, you know, what I think is that the movie takes a lot of shortcuts sometimes, because it doesn't need more than that. And whereas the novel tries to connect some scenes in a different way and mix them, I would say, a little bit more complicated in some aspects.
Right.
But only as so far as we need it as a reader to understand where the characters are coming from. And I think for the movie, he decided that a lot of these smaller details, if you so will, are not really important because it's a visual medium. But for the novel, he wanted to paint a more complex picture.
Well,
as Marvin would say, great picture.
That's the thing between movies and books. I mean, it's like you can really get detailed when you write the book. But with the movie, you really have to, like, it's almost like doing the podcast. You have to, like, pick and choose what you're going to, you know what I mean, leave stuff out and completely cut other things out. And with the book, you can really, like, that would be like a mini series where you include every last detail that you come up with. It would be in the book. So, but
I totally like that he's not, the story of the novel is not 100% following the narrative of the movie.
It's also
not radical. It's like reading a different draft of the script, maybe.
And also the movie only covers 3 days. The book covers like decades. It goes from like way back in Cliff's, you know, war days all the way up to 1999, basically. So you're covering a ton of time, a huge time frame there.
Yeah, and also like I forgot who said it, but it's also like this is Cliff's book, right. So there's a lot more of Cliff in there, and we see a lot more of that world or of these 3 days and of the memories of the characters through Cliff's life point of view, and not just his point of view at the moment, but also his maybe call it hindsight or his memories.
I was wondering, like, between Rick and Cliff in the movie and Rick and Cliff in the book, I found them not really as likable in the book. They were a little bit more like rough around the edges in the book, I thought. I don't know about what you thought.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, for one, I think Rick Dalton's, I don't want to say arrogance maybe or ignorance when it comes to the art form comes across a lot more in the novel, and for Cliff, obviously the fact that he's a killer and all these things, they're not as fleshed out in the book, in the movie either. Yeah,
I mean, it's like, you know, because Rick, like, you know, he's sort of like a bitter bipolar drunk that hates hippies in the movie. But I mean, in the book, he, like, you know, he doesn't come across as like really that sympathetic. I mean, you understand like where he's coming from in a way, but he's not like we'll get to Aldo Ray later on in the podcast, but he's not like he's kind of like bringing it on himself because he's kind of ignorant. He doesn't want to change. And then there's Cliff, who's like, you know, he's still like, he's really mysterious in the movie, but then when you read the book, you find out a lot more about him, and he has a pretty dark past. I mean, he's done some pretty nasty stuff.
Okay. Yeah, and also what makes this more interesting in the novel also is that the development that Rick makes from struggling and being at a point in his career where he doesn't really know what's going to happen to finding maybe, I don't want to call it a new start, but in the end of the novel, it's a lot more clear in comparison to the movie where his future will lead him to, and that makes so much more sense if we learn more about his character flaws as we do in the book, versus, you know, in the movie he needs to be a bit more of a hero / anti-hero than in the novel, because it's a movie.
Because in the book he's really like, you know, he's really like indulgent, you know, in his problems and stuff. And he's not really like, you know, we kind of like see him kind of coming out of it. Well, actually at some point we do see him coming out of it, his problems, like at the very end of the book. But, you know, like it's in the movie, it's more like, you know, it has to be, you have to like the guy a little bit and not be so like turned off by a lot of the stuff he does. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like,
and maybe because, that there's always a discussion of whether, you know, modern cinema, you know, is it more about anti-heroes than heroes, or who's the audience identifying with? Right. And there's of course something to be said about, you know, this being or having been a blockbuster movie with two of the biggest stars that we have. Obviously, these are people that we like and people that we admire and maybe aspire to. But the characters are different from the actors, of course.
That's what I was going to say. You're watching Leo and Brad, and you've seen these guys in other movies, and you're fans of them. But I mean, if you're just reading the book and those guys aren't involved in it, you don't really see it. You don't feel the same way. I didn't feel the same way about Cliff and Rick. They were sort of they were like Hateful Eight type guys. You know what I mean? Like, they weren't you weren't completely likable to me. You know what I mean? They were kind of like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Also, Leo wouldn't cry in front of the Mexicans, but Rick would.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, Cliff is like, you know, we'll have to talk about some of the stuff Cliff's done, but you know, and like in the movie, like it's alluded to that he killed his wife. Well, read the book and you'll be like, wow, this guy, he's done a lot worse stuff than even that. But the book about it, him killing his wife, is like pretty nasty stuff. It's like a horror movie or something, you know?
Yeah. And but not only that, I mean, there's a lot more in the book, obviously, that contributes to that
right
mystery of Cliff.
Yeah.
Some good and some bad also. Yeah. I love it because one thing that you learn very early in the book is that, you know, Quentin suddenly he has a tool at his disposal that he doesn't have as much on the screen, where he can suddenly use his character's thoughts also to convey like movie knowledge and trivia and all these things. And that was one of the things that I enjoyed the most. I mean, who knew that Cliff Booth would be kind of like a movie critic?
Movie buff aspect. Yeah, that was kind of cool. I didn't know, you know, you don't know that, but I mean, there's like a whole past of him like going to the movies and like, you know, he has his favorite Kurosawa films, and there's like a list of his favorite films in the book. And, you know, and he references the Street Fighter, Sonny Chiba, who we have to give a shout out to, who just passed away yesterday.
Unfortunately.
I can dedicate this podcast to him because we're a bit huge fans of him. But, you know, there's a whole thing about Cliff, like, you know, and his like, you know, movie preferences, and like, you know, he's kind of like not a critic, but he just has like his little ideas of what he likes and stuff. And that was really cool. And you don't get that in the movie, of course. It's just not enough time to do all that. So.
No, and also I think you know, of course, being a lifelong almost Tarantino fan, I always dug reading his scripts because they're not just technical instructions; they have great prose. And right. And here for the first time, in a novel format, he gets to, you know, act out that inner poet of his, I thought. And there's, you know, this novelization, this is obviously not Hemingway or anything, and it's not meant to be, but there's a lot of small stuff in that I really liked. I'm not sure about you, but I wrote down a few things, or if I had a highlighter with me on my Kindle, I would have highlighted them because I thought, oh my God, that's such great writing.
There's so much stuff. And another thing was that he said that basically he spent his entire life, you know, learning what he learned about movies and TV so he could make this movie, which makes a lot of sense, because to me, it's about as authentic as a movie about this subject as I've ever seen. I mean, you know what I mean? That's the whole thing about Rick and Cliff. And it's almost like you're watching a biopic of these guys, even though they didn't exist. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you watch their adventures going on. Then you go over to Sharon. Then you come back to them. To me, they're real people. They're just like completely real. I totally like, you know, it's like I was kind of thinking to myself, like, this doesn't really make complete sense. But you know how Rick kind of lives on the corner, like next to Sharon? I kind of felt like this doesn't, you know, this probably won't make total sense. But I kind of think like Rick is like living on the corner of the Tarantino universe, and Sharon is in the real world universe, and that he kind of like crosses over into, I don't know. That was just a little theory I came up with in a way, but it doesn't make sense, but it kind of does. But I thought that was the authenticity of the characters were what I really like loved the most. I just thought it was so real. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And if you remember that the movie closes with almost like a fairy tale kind of music and end title card. Yep. And I think that matches what you just said. Is, yeah, I mean, in the end, it's still, you know, it's still a fairy tale because Hollywood's all about fairy tales. Right. So I could imagine that, yeah, he lives on just the cusp from, you know, leaving one Tarantino verse to entering another one, maybe.
Right. I just really like, I love that. I guess that was the whole that's the point of the movie, like, you know, the fairy tale aspect, like you were saying, the once upon a time aspect. But I just, you know, I just thought that was really like a neat little touch, like how he kind of lived on the corner and like her gates were like right next to, I don't know. I just love that, the way he did that. That was just the cool.
Maybe because before we get into some of our favorite parts of the novel, because we haven't talked about that before, maybe let's jump just a little bit and talk about some of the references, because obviously both of us, we're all about Tarantino references. I think one of the most famous or most popular things we've ever done for the Quentin Tarantino archives is that Kill Bill movie references guide. I think to this day, this is the most popular content on the website. Yeah. So obviously, and the book obviously has even more references than the movie. You know?
Yep. It's just like a treasure trove of stuff. I mean, I could like read the references in the first chapter. I'll read them like really fast. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it starts with Tom Laughlin of Billy Jack, Gidget, Paul Wencos, a director, Cliff Robertson, the actor, Battle of the Coral Sea, that's a film, Ralph Meeker, an actor, Michael Callan, another actor, Edward G. Robinson, he's an actor, Fabian, another actor, singer, The Virginian, that TV Western TV show, Joseph Cotten, the actor, Sergio Corbucci, the director, Ishiro Honda, a director, Van Johnson, the actor, Russ Tamblyn, I'll just read the names. Russ Tamblyn, Farley Granger, Mel Ferrer, Lee Marvin for a few dollars more, Sergio Leone, Lee Van Cleef, Gardner McKay, Tales of Wells Fargo, Robert Taylor, Glenn Ford, Stuart Granger, Bud Springsteen, William Whitney, Harmon Jones, John English, Craig Hill, Ron Eli, Tarzan, Yakima Canutt, John Ford, Stagecoach, Riverboat, Burt Reynolds, Jack Lord, George Cukor, The Chapman Report, Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., Glynis Johns, Betty Grable, Jennings Lang, Universal Pictures, Avco Embassy, National General Pictures, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Irving Allen, Walter Wanger, Green Hornet, Land of the Giants, FBI, Quinn Martin, Bob Robert Conrad, Kent Taylor, The Great Escape, John Sturges, Steve McQueen, Guns of the Navarone, On the River Quiet, The Victors, Carl Foreman, George Maharis, George Chakaris, George Papard, Paul Newman, Bobby Darin, Robert Wise, Tino De Laurentiis, Chyna Chita, Gina Lola Brigida, Marlon Brando, Warren Beatty, George Hamilton, Charles Bronson, James Coburn, Vic Morrow, Charlton Heston, Richard Widmark, Robert Mitchum, Henry Fonda, Rod Taylor, and Screen Gems. That's just the first chapter.
Yeah, and you know, as a movie geek, that, you know, your head explodes. And that's, as you said, that's just the tip of the iceberg, really.
That's one of the things I loved. I remember when I started reading the book, I'm like about two pages in, like it started with the references. I was like, yes, I love that. I was so happy like to read all that stuff. I just love like all that type of those little references and, you know?
Yeah. And when I read it, I was like, oh my God, this is going to take a few days until there's like the most epic letterboxed list of references. And you know, what happened just a few days later, there was a huge letterboxed list of all the references, of course. Yeah,
right. Everybody's doing that. They make the letterboxed list. But it's like another thing that's great about Quentin's stuff is when he makes those references, like in the movies he references different TV shows, movies, that makes you want to go watch the movies and the TV shows.
Exactly.
I do. You know what I mean? I say, what is that from? And then I find out and then I go watch that thing. That's what's awesome about it. You know, I mean, I don't know if probably not everyone does that. Some people just don't care that much and they don't get it. But for me, that's like the stuff I love. That's the little details and stuff.
Yeah, and I would even go as far and say that, you know, while you don't have to get it to enjoy a Tarantino movie, it seems, you know, it's almost suspicious, or maybe not suspicious, but it almost proves my point that a lot of the people who don't like Tarantino or don't get Tarantino are also those who don't appreciate all the, you know, the references and this kind of meta universe. And I think, and that's kind of my that's a thesis that I have, is that Tarantino has always been about that. Maybe not as explicitly as he is now later in his career, but he's always been about that. And I think those kind of critics or those who don't like his later work, they misunderstood what he's been standing for at the beginning of the career.
I mean, the whole thing with his movies is he's celebrating cinema and you know, pop culture basically in all its forms. He's not prejudiced against different types of movies. He loves everything. So it's like, if you love movies, and then you don't have to even care about that. Like, you know, his movies still work on their own without that stuff if you don't care about it. But if you love that stuff, that just makes them even better. You know what I mean? If you watch Kill Bill and you see all those little references to like Bruce Lee and, you know, Game of Death and, you know, just all the Kung Fu films and Westerns, if you don't have to get that to enjoy it. It still works on its own. But if you know of all that stuff and you love that stuff, it just makes the movie like skyrockets it into like another like level of coolness. You know?
Yeah, it's watching a Tarantino movie is being entertained and watching a great movie, but also it's like going to film school. So yeah, and if you read the novel, you're gonna learn more about, let's say, why Cannon for Cordoba is Cannon for Cordoba than you learn about Sharon Tate.
right. He really delves in. He'll delve into stuff that's not what someone else would delve into. He'll delve into, like, you know, the background stories of like different little actors or something, or like, you know, little incidents that have happened, but he won't delve into like more like, you know, obvious stuff, which is, that's what I love too. That's another little detail I love.
Yeah. And he's not doing that for name dropping or whatever, but he's doing that because that's what he is all about.
Right. I mean, you know, in the authenticity aspect, it's like he learned about a lot of these stories that are in the book from like Kurt Russell and Bruce Dern. Those are the guys that were actually there back when this stuff was going on. So it's really like, he knows all these stories. It's just awesome. It's just, you know, it's all real authentic stuff. You know, you're getting like the real stories and of like these different actors and, you know, the directors that, you know, did these things to them. And it's just interesting.
Yeah, and I like that, you know, it's not just descriptive what he's doing. Like, he's not just, you know, mentioning things and explaining things, but he's also judging them and contextualizing them and interpreting them. It's right. You know, it's not because I was, you know, just I'm actually in the middle of my Matt Helm movie marathon while we're recording this podcast, and it's not, you know, when you watch the movie, you're seeing part of a Matt Helm movie, and you think, ah, of course, if I'm going to read the novel, I'm going to learn maybe a little bit more about Dean Martin playing Matt Helm. And yes, of course you will. That's no secret. You will learn about, but not only will you learn about it, you will get kind of these little, I want to say, Tarantino-esque little side jabs. And there's one I want to read before we before I would love to hear some of your favorite references at this point. Yeah. But there's one thing that I highlighted that gave me a chuckle, because I mentioned earlier that there's these things in there that gave me little chuckles. Yeah. And there's one in there where he talks about Dean Martin playing Matt Helm, and he says, and I'm going to quote this, where he says, Dean Martin's deal on the Matt Helm movies was so good that he made more money in the first three than Sean Connery made on the first five Bond movies, which infuriated the Scottish tightwad Connery. So now we learn that he's a Scottish tightwad.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole book is like that. It's hilarious stuff. You know, I wanted to like skip to like one part that there was one character in one of the chapters. It was called Brandy, You're a Fine Girl. And that's the chapter about Brandy, the legendary Brandy, Cliff's dog. What is it? A pit bull? I think. Yeah. Pit bull, right?
I think so. Yeah. Or something like that. Yeah.
I wanted to point out there's a character in there and there's who's like a new character that's not in the film. And his name is Buster Cooley. And like, I was wondering like who you would cast as that, if like, you know, that part of, if that chapter was in the movie, who would you cast in that role? And I know who I would cast. I was just wondering who you would cast. Any ideas?
Yeah, I mean, my first thought was that he might probably pick one of his regulars because he does that. Right. So I was thinking of maybe Mike Bowen or Michael Madsen even. Yeah. But then I remembered that he might be kind of a shifty character, because there's this line in there where he says, Buster Cooley, what does it say? He's may have been a mooch, but he wasn't a chiseler. So I think it's a little, it's maybe a shiftier character. So I thought Scoot McNairy would also, you know.
No, that would be good. You might go, oh, aha, I should have thought of that. Was Walton Goggins. Chris Mannix from Hateful Eight. I just thought he would be like, if he showed up as Buster Cooley and he was kind of like doing his shtick, like, you know, kind of like a southern dude, like, you know, like kind of shifty and like, you know, kind of that sense of humor. I thought he would be like perfect for that role.
That's a good point. Either that, or maybe I'm not sure from the book, I didn't gather how old Buster Cooley was, but I could also like imagine a young LQ Jones.
Right.
If he was still young.
He was a younger, someone like that, or like Strother Martin or something. I don't know. It's one of those guys. Guys or something. But I just thought like he was sort of like a kind of like a comedic type. He'd be like a kind of a, you know, comedic type character, you know what I mean? With like kind of a funny quirks and stuff.
Yeah, so you like that chapter, the Brandy chapter?
That was a good one. Yeah, that was good. And that's another one of the Cliff chapters, and that, you know, that kind of like sheds more light on his past, and it's another dark one. You know, it's like through the whole book, Cliff is sort of like a, you know, he's sort of like a psycho and like a maniac, but he's not, he's like really cool. He's like Steve McQueen on the outside, but like on the inside, he's like a friggin' monster or something. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, I mean, and also this is one of those where it's not like you want to know all about the dog, but it helps so much if you know the backstory.
Yeah, it does, especially because of the end of the movie when she goes nuts. That's where that came from. The dog fighting. She was in dog fights, so that's why she's like very really trained really well and stuff. So that's a connection between those.
Yeah, and there's all these haters that would be like, oh, Quentin, he's showing us people eating and watching movies and having dinner. I'm like, no, this is an important part of the character development that you will need to know.
Fills it in that little section that you don't know about their background together and like why she's like trained so well and everything. It was really good. That was an awesome chapter. And I didn't expect, like, you know, what happened to Buster in there to happen either. You don't expect that. You're like, oh, this is kind of fun. And then all of a sudden, like, nope. That's the end of that guy. That was awesome. So should we go through the chapters now?
I want to say I didn't have a particular favorite, but if I had to, I would say that I probably prefer the first half or so of the book to the second or so. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I liked a lot of the chapters, like the Pussycat's Creepy Crawl. That was a good one because I don't know if you know like what a creepy crawl is, but Charles Manson, like him and his followers, they'd go out at night. Like, and they'd break into people's houses and then they'd like rearrange the furniture, like while the people were sleeping. And then like the people would wake up the next morning, like all their stuff would be like backwards and like upside down. That was what a creepy crawl was. And I guess like, you know, in the book, there's a whole chapter on Pussycat what's the girl's name that plays her? I forget her name.
Margaret Qualley.
Margaret Qualley. Yeah. She plays her in the movie, but she's like, you know, sort of a big part in the movie, but in this chapter of the book, she like breaks into the house and there's a whole thing about how like Charlie is in her head. And it's like a real weird psychological thing, like how she's like trying to like follow his rules and stuff. And then she like breaks into the person's house while they're sleeping. And I just thought that was really cool the way it was like written and described. It was very like atmospheric, like at night, you know, it was awesome.
I think it also, it puzzled me because it's not one of my favorite parts in the book, but especially if you listen to some of the stuff that Quentin said about what he learned about Manson, is that I think that this whole creepy crawl chapter serves to illustrate the power he had over these girls.
Yeah, exactly what it is. It's he's like, he's kind of like controlling her and she's like, kind of like, you know, listening to, like, it's almost like he's in her head, like, and he's telling her what to do, and they're like having a conversation in her head, but he's not actually with her in the house. It was really weird. I mean, I think that's really what the, you know, the whole thing with him and his followers, it gets into that whole psychological, you know, brainwashing aspect, which was really awesome.
Yeah, and we're gonna jump back to that, but also, I mean, he might be a shitty musician, but he was great at manipulating people.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, you know, he was close. He was like, you know, it's one of those things that's really interesting about that story is because he was kind of hanging out with a bunch of famous people like Neil Young and Dennis Wilson, and he, you know, it's almost like fate, kind of, or, you know, it wasn't fate, but I guess he was just too crazy. He was just a little bit too off kilter for them to, like, you know, help him out. But like, if he was just a normal guy, he probably would have got pretty far in that, in like a musical career. You know what I mean? In that era, You know what I mean?
Yeah, because it was a crazy era. I mean, all the stuff that happened.
Oh, hey, fuck you, Jack.
He was just too crazy, I think. You know what I mean? He just had that thing, like a demon on in him. You know what I mean? Or you couldn't be like a regular person. But it's just really a really interesting aspect of that. And then what about the chapter about Cliff and his wife is another one that's really like crazy. That was like, you know, because in the movie, like, that's such a big part of the film. Like, it's alluded to that he killed his wife, but you're not sure if he did or not. But then in the book, it's like, it tells exactly what happened, like, you know, detail, gory detail. And it's like pretty shocking stuff.
But also the book is also not 100% because it's from Cliff's perspective.
Yeah, but it's like, yeah, but it's not. But I mean, he like cuts her in half with a harpoon.
Yeah, yeah. But did he murder her or was it an accident? It's still not. There's a little doubt left.
The thing about the hair trigger on the harpoon or something, like, you know, he just like, you know, twitched and the thing went off and he cut her in half. But then it's just very like gross. It's like nasty the way it's described and everything. But that was you're not really expecting that. You expect him to like kill her or something, but not like in like such a graphic way. Like, he basically cuts her in half in two pieces. It's like the Black Dahlia or something. It was just crazy shit.
Yeah, and obviously it there's two aspects that I think are important. That this is the late 60s and it's, I don't know if it's a sign of the time, but of course, and the movie makes a point of that he gets away with this because it's such a plausible thing.
Oh yeah.
I mean, obviously there's no witnesses or nothing, but what he tells the cops is just maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but it's plausible. And the other thing is we know that it's plausible because of the Natalie Wood what's his name again story.
But the fact that he cut her in half was a bit different.
It's a little bit gnarly.
You know, Cliff has, he's sort of like Stuntman Mike, you know Stuntman Mike, of course, from Death Proof. He has a little bit of that in him, that type of like kind of killer thing, like where, like, you know, he does like terrible shit and then, like, you know, he says, oh yeah, I got into an accident, it was like, it wasn't my fault, you know what I mean? He has a little bit of that like kind of like psychopath type of thing going on, which is kind of creepy too, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I like a bit of trivia. I mean, we're gonna get to back to some trivia later too, but I'm just thinking of one piece of trivia here, is that the actress who plays Cliff's wife in the movie, which Tarantino or Tarantino related production have we seen her before? I'm not sure if you can guess that one.
Rebecca Gayhart, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she was in, I'm trying to think what she was, if she was on like 90210 or something. I don't know. I can't remember, like years ago, but she was on some show that I used to watch.
Yeah. And she was in From Dusk Till Dawn 3.
Yeah. I haven't seen her in a long, long time, so I don't know. But yeah, she was. That was a good character.
Funny detail.
Yeah. What's another chapter that was different from the movie? Oh yeah, the Spahn Ranch chapter was different too.
Yeah, and there was, it was different from a narrative sense.
Right,
the book retells the whole thing from Squeaky's perspective.
Right. In the movie, it's like you're seeing it, like, you know, Cliff is kind of going in and talking to George Spahn in his room, but like in the book, you're seeing it from Squeaky's point of view. She's like kind of like trying to listen to what's going on. We don't get the dialogue from them. It's just her, like, you know, listening to it and what's going on. That was kind of interesting too. I like that little change from the movie.
I mean, the movie Quentin makes a big point of, you know, that scene in the movie is kind of creepy because the audience has a sense of
danger,
and also foreboding, maybe.
In the book, it's
more like, okay, so there's an intruder or like an outsider to our community, but we are in control. Like,
The music from the movie on the TV adds a little bit more suspense to it. I think it's from a Hitchcock movie or something, Torn Curtain or something. That music
could be,
and then, but it's like that whole aspect is taken away in the book. It's not, you don't get that, like, that kind of creepy, like, you know, is George dead in the room, or, you know, is Squeaky going to come in with a shotgun and blow him away? You know, you don't know what's going to happen. You know what I mean? You don't get that feeling. You don't know what the hell, because it's a Tarantino movie. So you expect like anything can happen. You don't know if like the kids are going to rush in with like, you know, sickles and like, you know, axes or something.
Yeah, and also like in the movie, it's like you wonder, just like Cliff wonders, is George sort of being kidnapped or tricked by these kids because he's blind? Does he not realize that there are like 50 of them?
It's like he doesn't know, like, you know, George is like kind of being held captive or something, or, you know, against his will. And he's like, George is like basically telling him to get the hell out of it. He doesn't even care. He's like yelling at him and stuff. That whole part was funny.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, we love Bruce Dern.
And that's another thing that's interesting about Cliff, is like those different sides to him. Like he'll have like that killer side where he'll like break someone's neck like 1 minute, but then he'll go and check on somebody that he hasn't seen in 8 years. It's like these weird, you know what I mean? These weird like sides to him, which is like, that's what makes him so interesting.
Yeah, he tries, as he says.
He tries to help people. And, you know, it's just interesting stuff. It's awesome. What's another good chapter in there? Well, the Lancer chapters were interesting because those were like, those are more like classic Western chapters in a book. They were less Tarantino, more traditional Western, like kind of like you were saying, Elmore Leonard or Louis L'Amour, or like that type of thing. There wasn't as much Tarantino in there, I guess, for some reason.
Yeah, and what I found interesting also about the Lancer backstory, there's a few things that, you know, that got me thinking. And one of them is, of course, there's a little Hell Ride reference in there, I thought, with, you know, there's one character saying something about Ladies' Night, which reminded me of that, I think Dennis Hopper line and Hell Ride.
You love that Hell Ride movie. I haven't seen it in a while.
It's a guilty pleasure. I like it. And in a way, how should I put this? So this entire Madrid Decatur dynamic is suddenly becomes a little bit more fleshed out. In the movie, you have more or less no idea about the relationship between the two. And also like the, you know, why the meeting that they're having in the saloon is so delicate. You don't know that in the movie. And for the sake of the movie, I think you don't have to. But in the movie, I think the scene is about, shall we say, illustrating where Rick Dalton is at in terms of his acting abilities, and where he's, you know, from he comes from a point of insecurity and alcoholism, and he tries to become more like a serious actor. But in the book, we learn more about the characters in that TV show. We learn more about Decatur and Johnny Madrid. So I think what, you know, the movie had us observing and following Rick playing the scene. The novel had us diving into the Lancer universe. And that's where kind of Decatur is a guest. And therefore, Rick is a guest. It almost turns it on its head. And I thought that really interesting.
Yeah, I never thought of that. That's really interesting. And another chapter that I really liked was the Medal of Honor chapter. That was the one where I think Cliff is like, he meets some girl that he used to know. In like Cleveland or something. It's just a weird, it's like a totally like, you know, it's like outside of like the movie story. It's like way, like it's in the past. I don't know if it's like right after he comes back from the war, but he's at some bar, like a pizza place with some girl that he used to know. And these mobsters come in and he's like, you know, they're like threatening him and stuff. And he's like, you know, and then he like takes out his medal and like puts it on the table and says, you know, I'm going to kill you if you don't, you know, back off or something. I can't remember the exact details of it, but that whole chapter reminded me of, I don't know if you ever saw the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the Roger Corman movie. I don't know.
Yeah, I've seen that just a few weeks ago.
That atmosphere. I don't know if it was at the same time. It was probably after that, way after that, but it just had that sort of like that kind of vibe to it. I don't know why. It just reminded me of that, even though it's probably like in a different, you know, different year. It's probably in the 50s or something like that, but that movie takes place like in the 20s or 30s, but it reminded me of that movie for some reason. I don't know why, just the way like the atmosphere of it for some reason.
Yeah, and I think there's two things that I mean, of course I think it's, you know, it would be amazing if Quentin went and made a movie that was set in like the 30s. It's Cliff being kind of the Audie Murphy war hero in the mobster setting. What? He has talked about this, because from all that we know is that his Star Trek idea revolves around things, right?
They go back in time to the 30s, and they're like, and I think that was an actual episode of the TV show. I think they did that in the TV show too. They went back
and
it was in Chicago, and they were kind of like around Al Capone and stuff. It was like weird. I don't know. I only saw it like once or twice, but that would be an awesome movie. I mean, I'd love to see that too. But it's like, you know, I don't know what he's going to do for his last movie, but I don't think
I think Paramount has the balls.
I don't think they're going to do Star Trek, are they? They're probably not going to do that.
Anyone's guess. I mean, I think sci-fi would be a great genre for him.
That would be cool, just to see what he would do with, like, you know, that type of, because he always does stuff like that's more like, you know, grounded and not, you know, Kill Bill is crazy. That's like, you know, kind of comic book type stuff, but just to do sci-fi and see how he would do it would be awesome, you know?
Yeah, it would be nothing like you would expect.
Yeah, it would be really different. I bet he'd use a lot of, like, you know, real, like, you know, effects, like special effects that weren't like digital and stuff like that, you know, like.
Yeah, 2 days ago, I watched like a really low budget sci-fi movie, like an Italian sci-fi movie from the 60s. And I thought, you know, he might do just that.
Real cheap, like, I don't know, that's almost like too cheap. It's like, you know, stuff on strings and everything. You know, it's like, you can do it. I'm sure you could even do it nowadays because they have better technology and stuff. But
yeah,
you'd have to see what he'd do. But it would be awesome. It'd probably be like The Thing, like something like that with like the real, you know, those crazy animatronics and stuff.
Probably. And I recently rewatched that one as well. And I thought, yeah, I mean, it's a sci-fi movie kind of. And yeah, it's a horror movie. But it's just a really creepy character observation film. And yeah, it's so similar to The Hateful Eight. It's all about paranoia.
If you watch Reservoir Dogs, it's like basically The Thing without The Thing, because it's all about, like, you know, who's the rat type thing. So same basic idea. And Hateful Eight too has the same.
Yeah, and The Hateful Eight, and funny that you should mention Reservoir Dogs, because there's a line in there where he describes Joe Cabot and he says he's the thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's another thing. That's the comic book thing.
Yeah, that's funny. And just as a side note, because I recently rewatched The Thing, there's the final line. How great is that? Where he says, "So how are we gonna get out of here?" And he says, maybe we shouldn't.
Yeah, that is a good line. It's such a bleak ending. It's like, you know, it's like, talk about bleak. That's about as bleak as it gets. You don't even know what happens to them. They're just sitting there, like, you know, in the dark with like the whole place burnt down. That was crazy. Yeah, that's an awesome film, though. So awesome. The way they set it up. And the blood test scene is also one of my most favorites. That's one of the best suspense sequences ever.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
What's another chapter that was different from the, we have to talk about the Drinker's Hall of Fame. I know you didn't love it, but I mean, that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. That's one thing that wasn't in the movie at all, obviously. I mean, I think there's one shot where we see Johnny Madrid drive off after a day of shooting on his motorcycle or whatever, but we don't know where he's going or so.
Right. And this is like after the Lancer shoot, they go to a bar called the Drinker's Hall of Fame. And I think it's Rick, Cliff, and Jim Stacy. And then they go, you know, they go and hang out and stuff. And that's where we see a guy named Kurt, who is a piano player. He's, you know, he works at the bar. And then his young son, Quentin, shows up, which is like, you know, you're like, wow, Quentin's in his own story. That's really awesome. That was really cool.
Yeah. So it's of course the young Quentin that he wrote in there in his real life stepdad, but also it's that scene or that chapter in the novel that's important, because we learn why Rick doesn't like it when people bring up the McQueen thing.
Yeah, that's a great part of that chapter too. You kind of he explains why he didn't get the part and like how he would never get it. It was never going to happen. Because we get that scene in the movie where Jim Stacy asks him about that, how, you know, the whole, because it's like, sort of like the story that goes around in Hollywood about Rick Dalton, like how he never got the part in The Great Escape and the Steve McQueen part. And then he kind of explains it a little bit. But then at the bar afterwards, he really like goes into even deeper detail of why he didn't get it. And it was just really good the way he explained that. I thought that was neat, too.
Yeah, and it's super plausible.
Yeah, definitely, right.
And then, I think.
There was another chapter that I really liked that was different was the Aldo Ray chapter, which is just, it's just like, it has nothing to do with like, well, you know, a little bit to do with this, with the characters, but it's sort of like just about him, like Aldo Ray, the actor, the 50s actor. And he's like off by himself, like at like a, you know, in a hotel or something. And are they shooting a movie? I guess he's shooting a movie with Rick Dalton and Cliff, right? Isn't that what it is?
Or they're shooting a different movie, because back then in Almeria, there was always like a whole bunch of productions going on at the same time.
Yeah, I guess that's what it was. They were on different movies or something, but then Cliff runs into Aldo Ray in a hotel, and he's like, you know, and Aldo Ray is like, he's barred from having booze. So he's like, you know, he's like fiending for like some booze, and Cliff walks by and starts talking to him. They have this conversation, and, you know, and he finds out all about him. And then what's interesting is about, you know, they make the comparison to Rick, like how Rick is like drinking all the time. And Aldo Ray is different because he's kind of using it because he has PTSD. So he's using it to kind of like, you know, cope with his, you know, that those like bad nightmares and stuff. And I thought that was really interesting too. That was kind of a cool aspect. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and as you said earlier, I mean, Cliff has two sides to him. One is like the caring person, and in this case, he cares about Aldo, and he does him a solid. But also, he's an asshole because he gives him that one thing that is really not good for him.
Right. It's just that's another awesome little detail of the story. And also, we have to mention Brad Pitt played Aldo Rain, who was named after Aldo Ray.
I was just going to say, Rain meets Ray.
You have to make that little connection. That's another little, you know, so it's like when you're reading this stuff, like you know what I mean? You're like always connecting stuff together, and there's all these little, you know, things kind of like circle around, and that's one of those little things. But some of the characters in the movie, like who was like your favorite, some of your favorite characters? Did you have like any other like newer characters, or did you like the way someone was written better in the book than maybe they were in the movie or something like that? You know what I mean? They got more time in the movie or the book.
You know, I liked Schwartz in the movie, or Schwartz. I liked him in the novel, maybe even more. Also, I liked him because his motivation becomes so much clearer in the book.
That's true.
It's not like he doesn't take the Schwartz meeting just like that. He gets sent by his agent to meet with him because he is, and we don't know that from the movie, he's a fixer. He fixes careers.
That's right, that's true. Yeah. And also the meeting doesn't take place in the bar like in the movie. Or you know, like how they have dinner or something at the Musso and Frank's. This is like, this thing takes place like in his office. So that was different too. That's kind of, it was like a different like alternate, you know, alternate version of like what happened in the movie.
Yeah, exactly. That's one thing. The other character I think that that I like, I mean, he's not much of a character, but I like the portrayal of Polanski in the book a lot more than in the movie. In the movie, he's like a grumpy guy who drinks his coffee in his backyard and probably doesn't like Sharon's dog all that much. But in the novel, it becomes a lot clearer. I think I'm not sure if that's Quentin's perspective, but in the novel it comes out a lot more that he is a really, really talented filmmaker.
Oh yeah, and I really like the section where it explains about how he shoved that made that scene in Rosemary's Baby. You know, the one where they're like where you're watching, you're looking, you're seeing the person inside the room, and like it's shot from a certain angle so that everybody like kind of looked around the corner like in their seats. I thought that was really interesting the way you described that. That was really cool. Yeah. Have you seen that, Rosemary's Baby?
Yeah, but it's been a while.
It's been a while. You probably don't remember that scene, but I know exactly what the scene he was talking about. So it's like everybody that was in the movie theater like actually tried to look around the corner of the door frame. It was just like really good. You'd have to watch that and you'll know what I'm talking about. It's really good. That was awesome.
Yeah.
One of my favorite characters. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say one of my favorite characters in the movie was Sam Wanamaker. I just thought he was like really like positive, and you know, it's full of energy and enthusiasm. I just thought he was like really funny and cool. That was probably one of my most favorite characters, you know, because like compared to like the other characters, he didn't have any like dark side to him. He was just very like positive and upbeat all the time, and you know, trying to support everybody. And I just thought that was really a good character.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think in the novel, it seems to me that he's a bit more selfish than in the movie. In the movie, it seems almost like he's a great director for Rick, but in the novel, it's like he plays Stacy and Dalton not against each other, but he does what he has to do to get those performances out of them.
That's what it is. Yeah, of course. He's kind of manipulative about the, you know, that type of stuff. So, but I thought he was just a really fun character. I just really liked that, you know, that portrayal by Nicholas Hammond. And also another reason I really liked it was because Nicholas Hammond was my first like movie, well, not movie hero, but like I used to watch the Spider-Man, the live action Spider-Man show. And that's like, so I kind of like had that connection to him as a little kid. And I just loved that he was like played that character. I don't know. I just really liked that. That was really cool for me. Connection.
Yeah, I think we touched on the Manson and the cliff. So maybe we should probably talk just a little bit about the elephant in the room, and that's the one character that's caused the most controversy is Bruce Lee, or let's say the character Bruce Lee as he is being portrayed in the movie.
Yeah, we call it the Bruce Lee issue. It's like, you know, that was sort of like the most, now from my perspective, that's like, okay, I didn't know like anything about that when I started watching the movie. So I was waiting for like Bruce to be like portrayed as like the Enter the Dragon Bruce Lee, like, you know, the cool guy that like everybody likes and everything, you know, he has that reputation, but I didn't expect for him to be like kind of portrayed like not a goofball, but he was sort of like, he wasn't like the super cool guy in that to me. He was sort of like just a loudmouth kind of like, you know, young loudmouth guy. You know what I mean? It was just weird. It was like a sour note. And I think a lot of people felt that way. Like, you know, cause we don't think of Bruce Lee like that. We think of him as like, you know, just the coolest, super cool dude. You know what I mean? So it's like when I didn't get that, I was like a little bit like, I was like, what's going on with this? That's all.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, that Bruce Lee is not the Bruce Lee that Cliff, the character, meets in the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Yeah,
you have to accept it on those terms. You know what I mean? That you have to just accept it on those terms. You can't like put your own view of Bruce Lee in there. That's just the way it was. He wasn't, and also he wasn't the Bruce Lee from Enter the Dragon at that time. He was like a young guy on the Green Hornet set. He wasn't, you know what I mean? He wasn't Bruce Lee yet. He was just like, you know, like a new guy. So it's like another aspect of it.
Yeah. And I mean, all in all, I would say the whole thing is super overblown. And I think that tabloids and whatever play their role. I think there's just four aspects that I want to mention. And I think that boils down my take on this. Is the one is, it's a damn movie. I think people need to get the fuck over it.
Yeah.
And B, the novel makes it clear that this is Cliff's perspective and there's a contemporary context to that meeting that makes that clearer, as you said, also where Bruce was at this point in his career. Yeah. The third, I think, is that if there's a character in the movie or the book that is portrayed in less favorable terms, I would personally say it's Steve McQueen, because it's depicted as kind of a whiny clown that is like, she likes Roman more than me or whatever. So and the fourth aspect,
I'm pretty sure in the book they say that he like was with Sharon Tate though. So it's like, it's not like, it's almost like he's, you know, I don't know. And also he was married at that time, by the way. So I mean, he's not like, you know, it's not like he's like really like in some bad situation with women or anything. He's just like, you know, I don't know. It's just a weird little scene when he's talking about Sharon and stuff, just sort of like to like give like a little information on like their little triangle of like, you know what I mean? Their little romantic triangle stuff going
exactly.
on.
Exactly. Yeah. And exactly. And also, I mean, Steve McQueen is also a legend. So the fourth aspect for me when it comes to Bruce Lee is that there's a lot about the person Bruce Lee to us and to everyone that it has more to do with a myth and legend.
Yes, that's true.
And you know, like with all myths and legends, people don't like these questions.
You know what I have to say is that almost everybody in the story is the same way. You look at Jim Stacy, you look at Steve, you know, they're all kind of like, they all have that like, it kind of shows them, like, you know, some people better than others, but then you find out, like, they, not all of them were, like, you know, perfect human beings. They were all kind of like flawed people, you know what I mean? Like Jim Stacy, like how he, you know, like in the movie, he's portrayed as like a really cool, like young person, a cool young actor. But then if you find out what happened later on, it was pretty terrible stuff. Like he got like into a car accident and he lost his arm and his leg and stuff like that. And, you know, he was arrested for sexual assault and, you know, like all this stuff. So it's like all these people that like, we kind of hold them in like a, you know, a bright light, like we a positive light, but there, a lot of them have like a dark side we don't even know about. And Bruce Lee was probably the same way. You know what I mean? We kind of see him as like, you know, a real, you know, super cool, nice, but he was probably pretty much, he had a big ego too. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, these were people and, you know, we're talking about the late 60s. There's no internet. I mean, you can't pull out all their tweets or whatever and prove if that person was this way or another way. I mean, we rely on stories and books and interviews of people that some of them have passed away. Others have maybe just a really vague recollection. And of course, his daughter is a really outspoken advocate of the myth and the legend that is her father. But also, how old was she at that time?
Like a little.
So how reliable an eyewitness to his character at that time is she really?
She wasn't, she probably, I don't think she, I don't even know if she was born when the Green Hornet was on. So she doesn't know what he was doing back then, which is, you know, that's an interesting aspect too. But it's like, you know, of course you don't want your, like, your father to be like looking like a jerk to people. You know what I mean? So especially because, you know, Bruce Lee's reputation, he's like an icon, a martial arts icon. He's not like ever put down in any way by people. You know what I mean? He's always held up in a high regard. So that's the whole thing with him. And that, you know, and I can accept, like, you know, the way he was portrayed, and I can, you know, I can kind of like, you know, just shuffle it off as like, you know, a movie and no big deal. But, you know, that's just not how I saw it from, you know, my perspective. That wasn't my perspective. So no big deal.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen the movie, I don't know, maybe 10 times or so. Whenever I saw it with people laughed during that scene. I never had the feeling that they were laughing at him.
Yeah,
I think they were laughing because it's a purposely slapstick scene.
Yeah, I mean, it is played, it's not the type of thing you're expecting. Like, it's sort of like a comedy, you know, it's like sort of funny and like, you know, it's sort of awkward and, you know what I mean? It's just not like what I expected, which is just the way it is. And I think that was probably the way Quentin wanted it to be anyways, you know what I mean? Because he always does stuff like that. It's like he throws a curveball at you. That type of thing. You know what I mean,
if we want to be analytical about it, maybe that's one part of the, because we talked about this in the beginning about him being all about the references and whether you need to know them in order to appreciate his work. Right. I think maybe that's one scene where he expected a bit too much of the audience in terms of movie references and contemporary context, just maybe.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know, like if he was just coming at it from, but I remember reading like in the report, you know, the interview or, you know, just a report about the movie, like how Brad Pitt was saying, you know, we can't do this to Bruce Lee. This is Bruce Lee. We can't make him look like a total idiot here. You know what I mean? And he kind of like, I guess they were even go further with that, like even further with that thing about Bruce Lee, like making him look kind of like, you know, like a jerk and stuff. And Brad didn't want to do that. So he was going for like that type of thing. And that's just, you know, I understand why people are like, kind of like, you know, not upset about, you know, but just not expecting that portrayal of him. And especially with like all the stuff in his own movies of like, you know, referencing like Bruce Lee, like in Kill Bill and stuff, you're not thinking like, oh yeah, he's in Kato and the Crazy 88s and stuff. You're not thinking like he's going to like, oh yeah, show Bruce Lee to be kind of like a loudmouth jerk guy. You know what I mean? I don't know. It was just,
You know, in the end it's a movie and there's certainly no intention to put down the man or whatever. It serves a purpose in that scene for Cliff's backstory. And that's pretty
much it's interesting. And also, like someone said, like, you know, it kind of sets Cliff up to be even more of a badass because he can kick Bruce Lee's ass. So it's like, you know, that type of thing. So whatever. I mean, I don't care. I love the movie and I love the books. So I don't care.
Yeah, and speaking of Cliff, though, we haven't really talked about the references that relate to him. And obviously, and as I'm sitting here as we're talking, I pulled out one of my items in my DVD Blu-ray collection, and it's the Billy Jack trilogy or a quadrilogy.
Yep, I think it's is it Billy Jack the
1, 2, 3, 4. So it's a quadrilogy. Yeah.
What are the movies? It's Billy Jack, Trial of Billy Jack, Billy Jack Goes to Washington, and then
Born Losers is the first one.
Yeah, those are fun movies. I like those.
Yeah, and Cliff, he looks like a Billy Jack.
And also, if I don't know if you know the trivia behind his Cliff is actually wearing Billy Jack's clothes from the Born Losers because he was the stuntman on the Born Losers, and when he was going to get paid, they asked him if he wanted Billy Jack's clothes as payment or to get paid like $500, and he chose Billy Jack's clothes as the payment. So those are the clothes he's wearing in the opening of the movie. He's wearing Billy Jack clothes, so that's why he looks like that, which is a cool bit of trivia.
Yeah, they're cool denims, and you know, it's the moccasins.
Yeah, those are
and both have like martial arts skills that have more to do with their service record than with like an actual martial art.
Right, and they were also friends in the Tarantino universe. They knew each other, and they were friends. They were all friends: Rick, Cliff, and Tom Laughlin. So
they're like cut from the same cloth, more or less.
Yeah, kind of grew up in the same way, and you know, I don't know if you know, but they do mention that like Tom Laughlin and Rick Dalton were in that movie. Was it the Battle of the Coral Sea or something like that? They were like both like all playing like characters in the, you know, in the, was it a submarine? I think, I don't know. I can't remember submarine. But I was watching several of those movies. Like, I think they were by Paul Wendkos, and they were like, you know, those ones that are referenced in the book, like the ones like Battle of the Coral Sea, and what was the other one? 611 Squadron or 665 Squadron, one of those. I can't remember the exact name of it. But the one thing I noticed about those movies is like they were perfectly fine. They weren't like, but they weren't like great. They were just like okay movies. You know what I mean? It was nothing really like outstanding about them. But they were like, you know, you could watch them and kind of like be entertained, but like they just weren't anything special. And I sort of thought that was sort of like Rick Dalton's like acting. He was sort of like, he was good, but he wasn't like outstanding. Like, you know, he wasn't like a Oscar winner type guy. He was just sort of like just good, passable type actor. You know what I mean?
That's an interesting aspect, because that's one way of looking at where Rick's at. It's not like he doesn't have a career. He has a career, but in order to continue to have a career, he needs to be more than just okay.
Right, and then you compare him to Steve McQueen, who is like, you know, the top of the very top of the pile of the actors. You know what I mean? So it's like you can kind of see that, you can kind of like, you know, compare and contrast those two. How they, you know what I mean? One guy is like, you know, really at the top of his game, and the other guy is like, you know, doing guest roles as villains on TV shows, which is like, you know, just, you know, it's not really very good. But
yeah, and that's why in a novel, his agent sends him to Marvin Schwartz and says, you know, Rick, if you don't get your break in Hollywood, you gotta go to Rome and star in Italian westerns.
Right, and that's how he first meets Sergio Corbucci, which is another one of our favorite directors that's made a bunch of awesome spaghetti westerns we love.
Which one's your favorite Corbucci movie?
My most favorite, I mean, I love The Great Silence. That's one of my most favorites, but I think Companeros is one of my most favorites too. Like, I really love those two. I love like Companeros and The Mercenary are like my two of my favorites. And then Navajo Joe, of course, and The Great Silence. Those are probably my most favorite ones.
Yeah, for me, it's probably The Mercenary.
Yeah, that's an awesome film.
He sells death to the highest bidder. He'll sell your life for what he thinks it's worth. He is The Mercenary. If you're not ready to buy, be ready to die. Mercenary. His gun does the rest. Franco Nero, Tony Musante, Jack Palance, Giovanna Rabbi. The mercenary, the sun at his back, a gun at his side, a town at his mercy.
I mean, the mercenary and compañeros are
basically
yeah. companion pieces.
Yeah, those are companion pieces, right?
And the interesting thing is that while they're extremely similar and they, you know, they share the same topic and right. some of the same characters.
Franco Nero is playing the same guy, right? The Swede, I think.
Pretty much. In one, he's like the Swede, and the other one, he's the Pole or Polak or whatever.
That's what it is. He's playing the same character.
Yeah, it's the same character. It's not doesn't have the same name, but I find it interesting that you know not only does the mercenary loom really large over Quentin's filmography. I mean, especially if you consider Kill Bill, but also the mercenary out of the two movies that are so similar, the mercenary seems to have the bigger reputation in the US, whereas Compañeros has a bigger reputation in Europe. It was almost like one of these movies where, you know, if you were part of the late 60s peace, love, and anti-war movement, you would go see that with a group of people and then go out and sing that song, Compañeros. It was almost like a hymn of the student movement in a way. I would say that, you know, Compañeros is probably a tad more political or a lot more political than The Mercenary, at least on the surface in terms of explicit.
Weren't they both sort of Zapata Westerns? I don't know if they...
Right. Yeah, they're both like about the revolution and they talk about, you know, the classes and the role of the foreigners as arms traders and, you know, how they profit from civil war. And no, we shouldn't forget this is during the Vietnam War.
Right. Yeah, it's true. I mean, you made some good points on that one. Yeah, definitely. I love those movies, though. Those are great.
Yeah, me too. I mean, the Spaghetti Western Database was, in a way, born out of, let's say, discovering more than one would usually know after seeing, you know, Kill Bill and such. So, it was Tarantino's movies who've opened up the Pandora's box for me, let's say, in a good way.
And then we also did the Grindhouse Cinema Database, which is sort of the same idea.
Yeah,
exploitation films that we found and, you know, put them into one big database and, like, you know, we put all the Blu-ray information and trivia, fun facts and all that stuff. And that was another awesome project that we worked on.
Yeah, and Rick gets sent to Rome, and he's not just doing a spaghetti western. He's also doing like a Eurospy movie.
Eurospy, Operation Dynamite.
Yeah,
that's what it is. Yeah, that's
and those are fun. All the polizios and he could have also made like a Giallo.
Yeah, I think he did. Wasn't Jigsaw Jane? I was going to mention that it was called Jigsaw Jane. That's another chapter that I liked was the one where Cliff is telling him how to like find out what it's like to kill somebody. That was pretty dark too. That's another dark chapter where he's like, he tells him to get a pig and to kill the pig and to like hold on to it while it dies. I mean, that's like crazy crap.
Yeah. That goes to show that, you know, I mean, Cliff does have a certain humor about what he is. I mean, he's perfectly aware that he's maybe a little bit of a psychopath, but he's doing that with like a chuckle.
And Rick is like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, he's like, he almost chokes on his food.
Rick is on his 10th whiskey sour. Like, what the hell? It was funny. Yeah. Yeah, that was another weird, crazy chapter. the pig, telling him how to kill a pig so he knows what it's like to kill somebody. But I think, yeah, I think Jigsaw Jane was a giallo. I think that's what it was another one of those movies he did in Italy, I think.
Isn't there in the movie, isn't there like the poster, isn't that hanging in his house?
Yeah, I think the poster's on the wall of his house is Jigsaw Jane. It's just,
yeah, I like that poster. Looks a bit like, I think, What Have You Done to Solange or something?
Yeah, it's one of those. It's just all like, just they're all kind of like together, like all those Italian spaghetti westerns and like Euro spy movies. And, you know, but that's another little detail I loved was that little section there.
Yeah, and he brings back his wife from Italy also.
Cappucci or whatever her name is. Something like that. Francesca Cappucci. And I think she was like kind of modeled after like Claudia Cardinale and Sophia Loren and like all those girls.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I personally would have loved to read more about his Italian adventures, if I want to be honest. If there's one thing that I was hoping for in the book that, you know, wasn't really met in terms of expectations, it was probably his European exploits.
Right. Yeah. It's you know, it's one of those things you can only cover so much stuff. You know what I mean? And also you want to like stay like in the story that's going on, you know, but I mean, it would have been awesome to like say, if he didn't do like a Lancer chapter, to like do like a chapter on like, you know, one of those, the spaghetti westerns that he did, like Nebraska Jim, like it would have been cool to like hear about like him, you know, in that universe too, but that's, oh well. You can only cover so much.
Yeah. So if we look at all the things we talked about, what would you, I mean, if you could, let's say you're Harper Collins and you had Quentin signed for a second book deal, which of his books do you think he should novelize?
I think Reservoir Dogs would be a really good novel. That would be interesting. Kind of like,
just, and he's talked about that, right?
Yeah, he has. And just to find out like all about those guys, like it would be like less about their like modern days and more about like, you know, what they did like in the past. So you'd find out about Toothpick Vic and, you know, Joe Cabot and like how they all knew each other and stuff like that. That would be a really cool one. And I also think Kill Bill would be an awesome novel, just like to learn about the divas, like all their history and stuff, like all their adventures that they went on and stuff. That would be awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those are probably my top two picks.
Yeah, I could imagine The Hateful Eight as an Agatha Christie crime flick that you could read over the Christmas break in front of your like fireplace.
Oh yeah, that would be cool too. Yeah, definitely. I mean, really, any of his stories would be awesome to like expand on, really. But those are just,
because The Hateful Eight is almost like one of those, because if I remember this, after the intermission, he jumps in as a narrator. He's like, yeah, somebody like poisoned the coffee.
Yeah, it is like an Agatha Christie like novel type thing, you know what I mean? In his own way. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, what was it patterned after, like 10 Little Indians or one of those stories?
Yeah, yeah. And just to name drop, when I went to the premiere of the movie in Berlin, right after that, like when the intermission came on and the lights went on, I went over to Quentin's seat and we chatted just for a second, and he's like, how did you like it? And I said, well, you know what, Quentin, I can't wait to find out who dies next.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome, man. And you got to meet him a couple times, which is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a while, though. Yeah, he needs to come back to Germany.
I know. I'm wondering what his last... Oh, yeah, we have to mention his next book is going to be Cinema Speculation, I think it's called, which is like all... I think it's all New Hollywood. It's all about those films. And I think it's all about like when... Instead of reviewing them now, it's all going to be about when he went to see him for like the first time when he was younger or something like that. So it'll be from that perspective. That should be really interesting. I love that. That's probably my favorite decade of film is the 70s.
I'm still not sure. Like I keep thinking of, I mean, obviously he makes a point in one of the podcasts he's been on that, you know, the 60s aren't the 60s. There's like the first half of the 60s that are more like the 50s. And then the second half, which is more like, you know, when New Hollywood started. And to me also, if I had to pick like a decade, or let's call it an era of cinema that's my favorite, it would also be that. If I were to make a list of the movies I like the most, I watch the most, or that have, you know, left the biggest impression on me, they would probably, like 80% of them would be from that time.
Yeah, me too. That's really my favorite, because I mean, I always go back to those. Those are the films I rewatch the most. All those 1970s films, like French Connection and, you know, Serpico and Scarecrow and just everything. The Sting. I could go on and on. The Godfather. Just all types of art house 70s movies, and I just love it. Crime movies, and you know.
I think there's one movie that they talked about also in one of the podcasts. I'm not sure if it's also mentioned in the novelization, but there was also a novelization of it. Is Hard Times.
Oh yeah, Hard Times. We should we're probably going to do a podcast on that in the future.
And I'm a huge Walter Hill Hill fan, and the first time I saw that movie. Because we mentioned this when we prepped for the podcast, I had seen that movie, I don't know, when I was a teenager on TV, yep. But when I rewatched it on this pristine Blu-ray restoration, I fell in love with like the colors and the textures and the atmosphere. That was a really cool movie.
It is a great movie. And that was his first movie too, which is like, you know, it's pretty awesome to make such a good movie on the first time, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons I'm looking forward to Cinema Speculation. I mean, we only know so much about that project, but one thing that we can assume that's going to be in that book is a lot of reviews.
Oh yeah, it's definitely going to be that. It's going to be all reviews and like just, you know, I think another aspect is he's going to like talk about movies that weren't made, but like, you know, what would have happened if they were made, like stuff like that, like all those types of little things. You know, like just talk about like, you know, different directors and like what they were going to do, but they didn't do, and what would have happened and that type of stuff, which was really interesting too. Not what you usually get in like, you know, books about movies. You usually just get like, you know, the reviews or something.
I think that's going to be another book that's going to be littered with highlights and post-its.
Yeah. I think it would be awesome to like have a book like that, but they get all types of like movie posters and stuff included, like all types of visual stuff. That would be really neat too.
Yeah.
Just like another text.
And speaking of trivia, I think if we look at the time, but before we kind of fade out, if you will, I think we should each pull out a piece of trivia question out of our sleeves, and okay. I let you start because we said we're gonna quiz each other.
Okay, so my trivia question is, let's see. Okay, in 1999, in the book, this is in the book universe, in 1999, Quentin Tarantino remade a movie that was originally scripted by John Sayles. Do you know the name? It was a gangster movie. Do you know the name of the movie?
Damn, I think you got me. So it's the one that got Trudy Fraser the Oscar, right?
Yeah, let's see. I gotta see.
Man.
Trudy Fraser was in it.
Yeah, and she got nominated for an Oscar or something.
Yeah, she did. I think it was Golden. Best Lead Actress Oscar in that movie. 1999 remake of a gangster movie. One of Quentin's favorite gangster movies. And it's also listed in the GC in the Grindhouse database. We have a little reference too.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna maybe you can give me one more hint and then to pull the phone choker.
I'm trying to think how to.
Because I'm bad with names. I it's on the tip of my tongue, but.
Well, Robert Forster was in it too. He had a role in it, and I think Robert Conrad was in it too. But okay, I'll give you one more clue. the name of the movie has a color in it. That's all I can say without telling you what it is.
Okay, is it a Lady in Red? No.
Yes, that's it.
Okay.
No, that's kind of tough because, I mean, if you haven't seen it or whatever.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it. But I'm a huge Robert Forster fan, just like Quentin.
It's a good movie. It's sort of like John Dillinger. Like it's about the girl that hooked up with John Dillinger. And, you know, it's like that era, like that, you know, the 30s gangster. Really good
another,
movie.
Because you mentioned New Hollywood, I think a movie that I recently watched with Robert Forster, it might have been one of his first, is Medium Cool.
Yeah, that's a good movie too. I've seen that. Yeah.
And yep. Also, what's another one I liked? Vigilante.
Yeah, and I really liked Walking the Edge. That just
got released. I haven't seen that. That just came out on Blu-ray, didn't it?
That's a good one too. I rewatched that like a couple weeks ago. That was really good.
Mm-hmm. Did you watch it on that new Blu-ray?
Yeah, I didn't watch it on Blu-ray. I watched it on like streaming.
Okay. Yep. Okay, so my trivia question to you is, both in the book and the movie, Manson stays at Terry Melcher's house.
Yep.
Who was Terry Melcher with romantically at the time?
Oh, God. Oh, man. Who was he with? Well, was it Sharon? It wasn't Sharon Tate, no.
No.
Who was he with?
But also a blonde.
Oh, man. I don't know if I'm going to get that. I can't remember. You know what? I can't remember.
Model, I think, and actress, and I think also activist. I'm not sure about
that. I'm going to know who it is when you tell me, but I just can't think of who it is.
Okay, so one of the movies I know her from was a Western that that touched on like the My Lai Vietnam massacre topic and contextualizes it in a Western setting. Damn. Or Western context. Man. And that movie is called Soldier Blue.
Oh, it's Candace Bergen.
Correct.
I needed a hint on that. Once I knew what movie it was, I knew it was her. Yeah. Okay. So we both got it. Good job.
And the movie's just, the book's just full of that. I mean, that's one of the reasons I love it.
Yeah, that's right.
And awesome. I want to circle back to one aspect that we started out with in the podcast, maybe as a parenthesis here at this, because we talked about the format first.
Yep.
And one thing I need to get this out is, he purposely wrote this as a paperback. And one of the really neat things, of course, is that the little ads at the end.
Oh yeah, right. Of course.
Including the Tom Breezy book and the the Switch. Yeah.
From Serpico, I think.
Serpico and Oliver's story, which doesn't ring a bell.
You know, Tom Breezy book, was that a real book?
No, I think that's the only one that's not real.
That's a fictional one? Okay. Mm-hmm. That was like a real book, and I don't know. I just got screwed up.
And then the last ad in there is, of course, the announcement of a deluxe hardcover edition of the book. And yeah. Quentin, I think he mentioned in one of the podcasts what this is going to look like. And it's no secret by now that it's not going to include any more material, but it might include like pictures and stuff like that.
Right.
One of the things that really bugged me is that, you know, I live in Germany, but so I went to the bookstore the other week and I wanted to look at the German translation of the book. I didn't want to buy it, also because I won it in like a giveaway or something. Yeah. But I wanted to take a look because the German publisher decided to turn this into a hardcover,
okay.
Which bugged me because, you know, it's against the express idea that Quentin has for the book. And right. Not only did they turn it into a hardcover, what was supposed to be purposely a paperback, but they also left out all these ads. They're not in there.
Oh, that stinks.
That stinks. Yeah, I mean, it's just, I had to get that out there.
That's not the traditional way that he wanted you to see it. It's like, you know, it's like getting like a different type of different cut of the movie or something, or, you know,
yeah, it's like taking a 240:1 and cutting it to 185:1, yeah. Because you think your audience doesn't know it better.
Like 90 minutes, you know, 30 minutes of the movie or something or whatever. Yeah, I didn't really know about that, but that stinks. But you got to get the real paperback.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're not having the full experience.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, I read it on the Kindle because I couldn't, you know, didn't want to wait until the paperback arrived, which arrived just weeks after the launch date. But now I do have the paperback, and it, of course, looks great. I love it.
Yeah, it's an awesome little paperback. And I don't really read that much. I mean, I read, you know, books every once in a while, but like, you know, it was just a special little thing to get this book because I don't, you know, I'm not like an avid reader, really. I mean, I, you know, every once in a while I'll pick something up, but
So I mean, it's such a quick and enjoyable read.
Yeah, it's a nice little book. Like you can just kind of put it in your car. Like if you go somewhere, you can bring it with you and reread it and stuff. And it's just really fun.
And really, as a Tarantino fan or as a movie buff, I think there's really no way around this book.
Yeah, I mean, you have to read it, but it's also you can kind of use it as a little guide. Like you can use it for if you haven't seen a lot of these movies and stuff, you can kind of use it as a little go-to book and try to find these movies online or order them on Blu-ray or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and just like his movies, the book is a piece of education, movie education.
It's a little pop culture education book.
Yeah, and what else is movie education is our websites, of course.
Of course, which is the Spaghetti Western Database and the Grindhouse Cinema Database, which have been online for a long time now. So we hope people check them out and, enjoy them. And, you can find us on Twitter. What's your Twitter? Is it... SW database?
Yeah, exactly. It's at SW database, and it's of course at Furious Cinema, and it's at GCDB, and it's at QT Archives, and we'll put that stuff of course into the show notes.
We'll have our little like promotional clips and stuff of our episode, and so people can check it out. And we've been waiting to do this for a long time. We've been trying to get our stuff together for like weeks. It takes a lot to focus, and that's the whole thing with me. Like I can do it, but I have to be like completely focused, and you want to make sure the sound is good. Hopefully the sound is good on this. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. I'm gonna have to get like a real good mic. We should probably invest in like a couple of good mics.
Yeah, and the most important thing is, of course, that you, the listeners out there, please leave us your comments, tweet us, let us know what you think. Obviously, we're not pros. We're just movie enthusiasts.
This is my first podcast, basically, and you've been on a few podcasts, but this is
not a lot. I mean, I've been a guest on a few, but that's pretty much the extent of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're enthusiasts, and we hope that you out there listening to this are enthusiasts. And we, of course, even if you read the book and watched the movie, we hope that you still learned a little bit from our discussion here and from our ideas and thoughts on the book and the movie. And if you have questions also and ideas of what we should talk about next, do let us know. We'll try to, of course, improve upon our ramblings.
As we keep going along, we'll probably improve more. We'll be a little bit more relaxed. You just got to get used to it. That's all. It's a different format. You're talking live. It's just not the usual thing.
Yeah, and also for me, at least personally, the podcast is a format that I've only recently started getting into more because listening is not my preferred medium.
You like to read or something?
I usually read. Yeah.
Me too. I listen to some podcasts, but it's just tough to. I'm so busy with other stuff. I don't have I have to kind of here and there. I do it, but.
I started putting podcasts on my phone, and then when I, take a walk in the park or something, I would listen to, Quentin talking to Mark Maron or whatever. I listen to most of that stuff in the park. Either I set up my hammock between two trees, or I take a walk around and get really some downtime.
I have to say, I really like comedy podcasts because it's like, because I'm into movies so much, and I've seen a lot of movies and stuff. So it's like that's not. It's not quite as interesting to me as like just having a good time and laughing and stuff. I don't know. I just, Cause I'm so into movies already.
Yeah, that's true. But I hugely enjoyed all the interviews and conversations.
Yeah. That was a good chat. I mean, that was my first podcast. So hopefully it's coming through loud and clear, and it was interesting to listen to, and, people had got some, ideas out of it, and became fans of our websites, and
that was a great conversation. And for those of you out there who are reading Furious Cinema, that we don't publish a review every day or so maybe this episode will make some of you also curious and dig a little bit into the movies that we wrote about in the last couple of years. You can just do a little search. Maybe we'll link a couple in the show notes that are from the era.
And don't forget to visit Spaghetti Western Database and Grindhouse Cinema Database. Those are our other sites. And we'll probably when we do more podcasts, we'll probably get into some of those types of movies. We'll get into exploitation movies and spaghetti westerns and that type of stuff. So stay tuned.
Exactly. We're going to help you all get a little bit more like Quentin, become movie buffs.
Yeah. We'll keep trying. So thanks to everybody for listening. And we'll see you next time. Take care, Seb.
See you soon.
See ya.
And that's that.